Gary Strignoli received his Bachelor and Master's of Science degrees in Electrical Engineering from the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. Upon graduation, he joined Zenith Electronics Corporation, where he worked as a design engineer in the Research and Development Department for 27 years. Currently, Gary is a DTV transmission consultant with Mintel Strignoli & Wallace. He has worked in the R&D design area on digital television transmission systems since 1991. Gary has been extensively involved in VSB transmission system design, its prototype implementation, the ATTC lab tests in Alexandria, Virginia, and both ACATS field tests in Charlotte, North Carolina. He holds 35 US patents. Gary was involved with the DTV station project in Washington, D.C., helping to develop DTV RF test plans. He has also been involved with numerous television broadcast stations around the country, training them for DTV field testing and data analysis, and participated in numerous DTV over-the-air demonstrations with the Grand Alliance in the ATSC. In addition to publishing technical papers and giving presentations at various conferences, he has held numerous digital VSB transmission system seminars across the country and was named SBE Educator of the Year in 2005. Please welcome Gary Strignoli.
Good morning. Today I'm going to talk about the mobile handheld system. First giving you an overview, then talk quickly about its history and give you an introduction to it. Then I'm going to review the legacy system that exists today that you're familiar with, except I'm going to put some parenthetical comments in about how the MH system is going to be backwards compatible with it. Then I'm going to go into some details about the transmission system, talk about the legacy system, and then be able to explain how it's backwards compatible. Go into the details of the MH system, a little bit about the field testing that has been done so far, make some recommendations, and then some closing thoughts. A lot of material. I'm just going to skim over at the 50,000-foot view. It's a very complicated system, but just to give you an idea of what is in the MH system, some of the slides have more details that I'm going to skip. If you want those details, you can download it from the WBA website whenever it's put on there. So let's start with some background. After fixed terrestrial broadcasting became established, broadcasters, like such as yourself, wanted to expand the services. They wanted more flexibility. Well, first of all, they wanted better receivers. Remember the modulation debate started with those lousy first-generation receivers that didn't have very good, not only ghost canceling or echo cancellation, but also overloading the tuner. But they also wanted repeater capability and some mobile handheld capability. They wanted the same RF spectrum usage, the same transmit powers, and interference protection, because if you got that, with backwards compatibility, all the investments made to that date in the on the consumer side, DTV sets, and on the broadcast side, all your exciters and so forth, you would save that, and the spectral allocations would be the same. So what are the benefits of the MH system? Well, you guys have the advantage over the cellular folks in that you are one to many. You're broadcasting. If everybody wants to watch the same big game, or more importantly, the news, if there's some kind of natural disaster or terrorist attack or whatever, you can send that to them all at the same time instead of using a bunch of individual circuits, which overloads their system. There's no outside provider needed. Data plan consumption charges is not, they're not there. You can provide high quality live local television. You have free and reliable propagation path, especially in times of emergency or catastrophe. How many times have you heard in the last 5-6 years, whether it's a hurricane or a tornado, earthquake, whatever, and the cellular system has gone down, and you guys are on the air, collectively across the country? And now there is an MEAS for the emergency alert system for the mobile side. That standard is in place. It's TV on the go everywhere. That's the new paradigm that we're talking about. There's really the triple play that you would have, high definition to the fixed receivers, and then SD to fixed and mobile. You can do free or pay services as desired. I think the early focus groups basically have shown you got to start off at least with free, and then maybe add some extended services that you might be able to get some money for, but the advertising-based free services seem to be what people want. You could also monitor consumer viewing habits via service and audience measurement. You say, well, there's no return path. Well, the devices can have a Wi-Fi that occasionally they have to hook up to the internet to get that information back to you, but they don't need it all the time. It's very simple, and the same signal broadcast out, the 19.4 megabits per second, the legacy receivers look for the normal PIDs, and they decode it as long as it's greater than the 15 dB signal-to-noise ratio that you're familiar with, whereas new receivers will find the MH data, where it is, and then decode that, but at 3 to 8 dB, much lower threshold, meaning more robust. Now, a little bit of the history. All I want to say about this is October to October, 2006 to 2009, 3 years that standard came out. Now, granted, they didn't start from scratch. This is an add-on, but it did go much faster than some people predicted. The other thing that just kills me is after 10-year transition, you guys turned off the analog, full power analog, went off on June 12, 2009, and 4 months later they announced, gee, you've given back channel 52 to 69, we want more of your spectrum. And then following that came the national broadband plan. Right now, though, there are 133 broadcast stations in 49 markets transmitting an MH signal, and I'm told 24 more are supposed to go on soon, whatever that means, before the end of the year, perhaps. We'll see. The OMVC was created in 2007, Open Mobile Video Coalition, and what they desired, obviously, is a single standard. You didn't want to have multiple standards out there. That really would be a kiss of death. They proposed a physical layer system. They did testing, IDOV, independent demonstration of viability. That's when two systems got tested. They were merged into one. The OMVC worked for MH standards. They funded various system testing, in particular the RF testing, and they've been an advocate to carriers, consumers, and device manufacturers. Now the OMVC, as of last December, has been rolled into the NAB. Now, right now there are two groups that you're aware of, Mobile Content Venture and Mobile 500 Alliance. They were created in 2010. They're branded as Dial TV and MyDTV. They are now pushing to see if they can commercialize it as soon as possible. Still don't like the idea of having two separate groups, and there's been talk at the NAB show and even in May about merging those two. During the summer, there's been silence, but a lot really doesn't happen or get announced in the summer, so we're waiting to see if that's really going to happen or not. Now, what are the general features? Obviously, it's a dual stream. A system. There's one transport stream coming out, but there are two streams mixed together. What's different is the MH has to have much greater FEC, forward error correction capability, and it has to have more training signals for instance, mobile. There's going to be faster dynamic multipath. So those are the two main things that are different. There's no addition of binary data at all. It's just more coding, both Reed-Solomon and convolutional coding. It's very data efficient, unlike the current terrestrial system, legacy system, which has a fixed 19.4 megabits per second. If you don't need all of it, you throw in null packets. Where here, you can change the data rate of the MH packets and trade off robustness. You know, you never get something for nothing in this life. Life is always made up of trade-offs. So if you want a higher data rate, it's not going to be quite as robust. If you want more robustness, you lower the data rate, and you have that capability. It also has the capability of burst data transmission, which allows the receiver, MH receiver, to power cycle. thereby extending the battery life. It's very efficient in its video and audio encoding, naturally. It's more modern, so therefore it's MPEG-4. So you get about a 2-to-1 advantage in encoding the video signal, and of course the audio is much more efficient. It's IP-based. IP is data transmission is ubiquitous these days. Now, it gets encapsulated into a transport stream. Why? Because it's got to be backwards compatible to the legacy system. But it is IP, which is what everything seems to be going to these days. You have viewer identification. That's that advertising information that you guys want. Actually, your advertisers want it. I guess they all don't believe that Nielsen is all that accurate. And I guess there came out a report very recently that basically showed that. So this would tell you exactly what people are watching and when and what they're doing. You have access control and paid service offerings, and it's easy to integrate into the ATSC broadcast system. There are no constraints on PSIP or the STL. That's all the same. So you have the same transmitter hardware infrastructure, identical signal formats. Legacy receivers are not affected, the same error correction capability, same performance. The audio decoder buffer constraints are there, and you have indistinguishable emitted RF spectral characteristics. In other words, if you looked at the spectrum analyzer, you couldn't tell if MH was there. If you looked at the decoded data at the output of the decoder, you couldn't tell what was MH or not. You need a special decoder to do that. Well, if the RF looks identical, the good news about that is you can keep the same broadcast RF channel assignments, well, until they repack, but it has nothing to do with MH. MH will go right with it. And you have no additional FCC authorization required to transmit MH. As far as I'm concerned, the more you can keep the government out of your business, the better it is. Now, standard legacy ATSC receivers, they will look for the PIDs. If they see a PID they don't recognize, what do they do right now? They gracefully discard it. People say, well, if they can't decode the MH anyway, why do you need to put the extra Reed Solomon, the legacy Reed Solomon on there? The answer is, if your TV set starts taking errors, whether it's in the program you're watching or any of the other data, it doesn't know at that point what data is, and it starts blanking the set. So therefore, to be backwards compatible, you have to make sure that the legacy receiver gets a good signal all the time. On the other hand, if you have the special new MH receivers, they know where the data is. I'll explain how they know in a few moments. And then they decode it, and that allows you indoor, portable, pedestrian, and mobile reception, thereby giving you these new features. Now, let's briefly review the terrestrial system that you know, but I'm going to put parentheses, comments on about the MH with its backwards compatibility. Now, you know, very familiar all these years, you've got a flat spectrum of very steep root raised cosine edges, and a 5.38 megahertz noise bandwidth, Nyquist frequency bandwidth, et cetera, that all stays the same. Nothing has changed, okay? If you look at the block diagrams, the data processing has a randomizer in the legacy system, Reed Solomon encoder, interleaver, and trellis coded modulation. That obviously has to stay the same when MH is added, but they have to do it in a way that it's backwards compatible. Now, keep in mind that this data interleaver is 4 milliseconds long, 52 packets. I will ask you to remember that number, 52 packets of dispersion of the data. That helps against burst noise. On the receive side, you just do the opposite in the legacy receiver. This is also the same when the MH signal stream is added. By the way, the three blocks with the black outline, the tuner, the linear equalizer, and the sync and timing. Those are the three blocks, by the way, that was greatly improved after those early days where the first generation, second generation receivers were so poor. Those are the areas that were improved significantly. Now, I mentioned you have transport packets in the legacy system, and part of that, in that 4-byte header, is a 13-bit program ID, or PID, that you guys are very well aware of. So you would insert a special PID in those packets that carried an encapsulated IP stream that had MH, and then add the 20 legacy Reed Solomon bytes for error correction, forward error correction, and the receivers on the legacy receivers then are very happy. As long as they say, oh, I got zero errors, I'm just going to throw away that packet. So you look at the data segment, and you see what should be very familiar to you. So what changes when you add the MH? The answer is absolutely nothing. You keep the same symbol rate, 10.7 megahertz rate, same symbol time, same 4-symbol binary sync, same pilot you add, same 3 bits per symbol, 2 of which are data, 1 of which is the trellis coding. You still have 188 bytes, a packet with 20 extra Reed Solomon bytes. Everything stays the same. Why? Because the MH data, when it's added, is encapsulated to be backwards compatible. Likewise, the binary frame sync, which repeats every 313th data segment, okay, which means 312 data segments are carrying real data. That number 312 will be important in a moment, so I want you to remember that. The only thing different is there are a couple bits changed in the reserved, just indicating MH is there, but I don't know who's going to look at it. The old receivers don't know to look there. The new receivers could, but why, if they're not decoding it? They're just going to gracefully discard the data anyway. Now, when you look at this type of data frame structure for the legacy, you know it's after the interleaving and ready for modulation because the syncs, segment syncs and data syncs are added. These field and frame syncs are added. By the way, similar to the old analog video, you have an odd and even field, although it has nothing to do with the video, as you well know by now. You also have to remember, and it's easy to make this mistake, that one data segment that's transmitted carries essentially the equivalent, underscore equivalent, of one packet. Why do I say it like that? Because in the legacy system, the data has been dispersed. The interleaver disperses it by, and remember this number, as I said, 52 packets. And it's not one byte being dispersed, it's 4 bytes at a time. The legacy system takes 4 bytes, leaves the first 4 bytes in the first packet, takes the next 4 bytes and delays it one segment, takes the next 4 bytes and delays it by 2 segments, and so on. It gives you kind of a diagonal pattern. So when you're looking at it, you can't tell it, but you need to know that one data segment really in the legacy system is carrying information from 52 different packets. Now, remember that diagonal, and maybe it's going to look like a sawtooth pattern to you. Remember that in a few moments. Now, you look at the 8VSB system characteristics, that all stays the same for the legacy data. Simple. The things that will change when you add MH is nothing to the performance of the 8VSB, but of course, they will not, those packets, MH packets, will have less data rate, but more robustness. So that 15 dB threshold will get much better, much lower. Now, you all know about the cliff. As you're traveling from the right side here to the left, as the signal to noise gets lower and lower, you've got a perfect picture. But within 1 dB, you go from a zero error perfect picture in sound to an all error frozen picture and muted sound. Now, you know that from the 8VSB system. That will still be the same for the legacy data when you add MH. And MH, would you expect, has a cliff? And the answer is yes, it's digital. The only difference is that cliff is going to be down here somewhere between 3 to 8 dB, much lower, which is good. Why is it so different, 3 to 8? Well, the answer is because you can vary the robustness by different types of coding. It's very flexible. I love to put these pictures up. I've been doing it for years in my seminars. This is a perfect signal as it just transitions into the binary frame sync. This you would expect to give you perfect picture and sound, right? This is just above 15 dB. This will also give you perfect picture and sound. That is the power of forward error correction, the concatenation of the Reed-Solomon and the convolutional coding. Now, let's talk about the MH system details. The slides are going to have more detail than I'm going to talk about. You cannot cover the MH system in 45 minutes or even an entire morning. So let's just hit on the high points that application engineers, such as yourself, who are not designing the chips, but working with it as a system, what can you learn from it? Well, let's not going to go through it in detail, but it really is quite simple. Gee, you see two channels. Well, it's a dual channel system. You see here, oh, I've got a video and audio encoder for the legacy side. Well, you've got that now. The only difference is on the other side for MH, you've got MPEG 4, twice the efficiency. And you've got AEC, likewise, a more efficient coding system for audio. You mux them together and you encapsulate it into transport stream, but in reality, it's IP on that side versus the MPEG 2 transport stream here. You put it together into an MH frame, which is synchronized to the legacy data frame that I showed you a few moments ago. And then you channel code it, it goes over the air, and everyone's happy. There's got to be one additional thing right here, and that's you've got to add signaling data, transport parameter control, and then also fast information channel. Remember I said that unlike the legacy system, which has a fixed data rate, you could have variable data rate. But how does the receiver know? You've got to tell it. But doesn't it mean that you have to code this much more robustly than the regular MH data, which of course is coded much more robustly than the legacy data? The answer is yes, and I'll talk to you about that in a moment. Now, without remembering all these numbers, it can get confusing when you're hearing this all at once, but just realize that the major block of data in MH is an MH frame. Look at that. That's not 968 microseconds. That's 968 milliseconds, almost 1 second. Did you hear that? 1 second. That will be very important when I explain part of the advantages of the additional FEC coding is that big, long Reed-Solomon frame that's going to fit in there. Okay? Then that's broken down into 5 subframes that are identical, and each subframe is broken down to 16 slots. A slot could contain the legacy data, all legacy data, or it can contain a combination of legacy and MH. Here's where the synchronization takes place. In one VSB field, you can put 2 slots, okay? That tells you it's synchronized between the legacy and the new MH system. Now, here is a field of data. It's 312 packets. Remember, the sync comes every 313th. 312 are data. That can be broken up into 2 slots. The slot can contain, as I said, all legacy data, or it could contain a combination of MH and legacy. There's never a case in the current implementation. There is a related standard that says you can use it all. Do you remember? You are under the requirement by the FCC to provide one free SD video on. So you can't use all of them up in the current implementation. I need you to remember this number, 118, okay? 118 packets is very important out of the 156. And 156 is half of 312 because there's 2 slots per field. Now, each of these slots can contain MH data or could be all legacy. But the slots that carry your particular program that you're interested in, when that comes around, like P0, the receiver turns on just for that slot, plus a little extra for the synchronization of the circuits and so forth. Well, that's how you can have battery life extension, okay? Not going to go through all this. Just look that if I were to take the maximum amount of MH data, and of course it takes it away from the legacy, you'd be taking away 14.7 megabits per second, leaving 4.7 for your legacy. Actually, that's overkill because you know these days a good MPEG-2 encoder could easily put two good SD programs on for that. But that's the way the system was designed. I said there's additional training signals. There's six training signals, get this, for every MH group. An MH group goes in a slot. There are two slots per field. So you have much more capability in your equalization. Well, of course, you want it for not only for the severe multipath you get from handheld, but fast dynamic multipath when you're moving in a vehicle that's going fairly fast. Five of the six are equally spaced. That's good for ghost canceling, for echo cancellation. They're longer than the binary field sync, which is sometimes used as the training signal. Also, you notice a short one, which has special characteristics, and that actually helps the MH receiver lock up. It also helps it quickly find the echo. You say, well, what goes in between it? That's going to be very robust data because it brackets, the two training signals bracket. And guess what? That's where the signaling data goes because that's extremely important. Not going to go through the details again, but look, the transmission parameter control, you have 10 payload bytes, and to it you add 8 Reed Solomon. Do you see the high percentage? 8 out of 18 is Reed Solomon. But not only that, you have concatenated with that a quarter rate, not half rate, but the more robust quarter rate convolutional coding. That's how they get the extra, and then it's bracketed by very closely by the two training signals. So that's the super protection that they give the signaling data. That's how important it is. Now, let's go back to that approximately 1 second MH frame where you put in that MH frame, you put an RS frame, Reed Solomon frame. Except the Reed Solomon data is going to get added at the bottom of this two-dimensional data frame. You say, okay, they're still using 187. Because in the legacy system, you have 187 bytes that are protected by 20 bytes. Here, they're doing the same thing, except vertically, which means, hey, that's stretched out even farther. Don't you get some added interleaving benefits? You betcha, a big difference. The legacy interleaver is 4 milliseconds. This one's 1 second. See the difference? Secondly, the other legacy, they're still here today, the current system has 20 bytes they add. It can correct up to half of those. So out of the 188 plus 20 bytes, 187 plus 20 bytes, it can correct up to 10 byte errors, half of the 20. Not bit errors, byte errors. That's pretty good. This can, you have a choice. Again, a choice of robustness, 24, 36, or 48. Even the 24, which most people don't use, can correct up to half of that, 12 bytes. So automatically you get a 10 to 12 difference, including the interleaving advantage. But most important, you've got the 48 choice. Now you can correct half of that, 24 bytes versus 10. If that's all there was, it would be fantastic. But wait, there's more. Now I sound like those insidious infomercials that you guys transmit overnight. The bottom line is you've got on the horizontal CRC checksums added. That's not error correction, but error detection, and it's bits. So, well, what does that do? If it detects an error horizontally, it takes all the bits in there because it doesn't know which one had the error, which byte, and says all those vertical columns, potential error, potential error, potential error. So what? Well, the Reed Solomon can go into a different mode of error correction, and knowing that the potential error exists at certain spots, can correct up to not half of these bytes, but all of them. So now you can correct up to 48 bytes on the MH under most, not all, but most conditions, versus 10 bytes. Do you see the big difference? Plus, you get the extra interleaving. As I said, before you do the legacy interleaving, the groups MH and the green ones here is the main data are nice and well-defined. But just like an analog filter, if you put a step in there, what happens? You get a kind of a transient response, right? Well, here, you're going to get a transient response that lasts, guess what? That magical number 52, because 52 segments is the dispersion length of the legacy interleaver. So that means there are going to be some data segments that have a mixture of legacy data and MH data. And there are going to be others that have all MH data. Notice that the training signals tend to bracket those data segments that have all MH. That was not designed by accident. That was done on purpose. So let's look at this. Remember I said 118 packets MH, whenever there is MH in a slot, 118 are MH and the remaining are data. If you take that added 52 packet dispersion, you get 170 segments. So what they did is they said, we're going to call these, in the RF domain, these data segments, we're going to call them blocks. 10 blocks of 16 segments. Well, you can do the math. That's only 160. What about the other 10? Well, they split it up, 5 before, 5 after, and they stuck in there all the legacy Reed Solomon bytes that are for the encapsulation process. In other words, it's not MH data. All the MH data was planned to fall within these 10 blocks. The two takeaways here are some blocks don't have the same amount of MH data, okay, which means they don't have the same robustness, because the more data you have for error correction, the better it is. And secondly, the training signals aren't quite as effective before and after. Now, yes, they try and interpolate in between and extrapolate on the outside, but what we're going to show you is that all data segments, all blocks, don't have the same amount of data and they don't have the same amount of robustness. And finally, they came up with this region definition where the four blocks of 16 data segments, they call the A region because that's all MH data, it's the most robust, and it's bracketed by the training signals for the best multipath cancellation. The next best would be the B block, just before and just after the A block. The next best is C, and then the worst is D. Now, why is that important for you to know on a high level? Is because you get to pick what type of coding in each of these four regions. Now, half-rate coding has more data. Only one out of two bits is for error correction, but it's the least robust. You really want to use half-rate coding for C and D? Not likely. You use quarter-rate coding there, but maybe B and most likely A, let's put half-rate there. You've got that flexibility, okay? Again, we're not going to go through this. Just know that there's a simple algebraic equation to calculate how much data is taken away from the 8 VSB legacy stream and also how much payload of the new MH there is. Okay? And by the way, when you do quarter rate code, it's not quarter rate. There's extra stuff beyond that that brings it down to something like 16%. Data rate, because you got to add the signaling data, you got to add the training signals, and so forth. If you looked at all the possible modes, you come up with 102. Gee, that's almost like the Windows operating system where you have a gazillion different ways to do the same thing. But in this case, most of the ways wouldn't apply to you. You wouldn't do it. You would limit it. And so you can limit it to half a dozen, maybe seven, eight, whatever, and trade off data rate for robustness. Now, as an example, if you're a network affiliate or an O&O, you would say, I got to put out a nice HD and I put out 12 megabits per second. I might have some additional multicast. I might only get two or three mobile video services, okay? On the other hand, you might be putting out a primary SD feed, add some SD multicast, and then, hey, I've got a lot more of data rate to spend on 4 to 8 mobiles, depending on the content that you have available and the content rights that you have available. Now, we're not going to go through the block diagram in detail. Just understand that there are two concatenated coding systems. One is the Reed-Solomon frame, that big two-dimensional frame I showed you that lasts for 968 milliseconds. The other one is called, it's a mouthful, Serial Concatenated Convolutional Code, SCCC. And you get three blocks do that. It's a trellis coder, interleaver, and another trellis coder. Okay, those three together are the SCCC, and that's separate in addition to the Reed-Solomon frame. Keep in mind, the takeaway from this is the third part here is the legacy trellis-coded modulation. Okay? Now, in the receive side, they just do the inverse. But here's the thing. You've heard of turbocharged engines for cars and trucks and so forth. Well, they have turbo coding, where you run it through once, and instead of making a hard decision between a 1 and a 0, they'll say, I'm going to put a probability value on this symbol. You know, I'm pretty sure it's 90% sure it's this, or I'm 10% sure, or I really don't know, 50%. They run it through and get an answer, and then they say, okay, let me reverse the process, go back to here, using that partially corrected signal. Then they run it through again, but now, each time you run it through, you're getting more and more accurate. This is running in real time, so you've got to do this very quick. That's why this process hasn't been used prior to this, because we didn't have the technology in the consumer chips. So that's the turbo decoding. Now, you know the 15 dB I talked about is the white noise threshold for 8 VSB. And for a complex echo scheme, does 10 hertz. Look at these different quarter rate and half rate. You can get down to 7 point something and 3 point something, respectively, dB at white noise threshold. Okay, you could have a much lower signal to noise. And, of course, the Doppler rate that you can correct is much higher, which is important if you're going to do mobile, right? Now, let's talk about the summary. The OMVC has done a lot of, or sponsored a lot of testing. So where you start with a nice van, put in a generator in it, you put in a rack system, and you wire up the equipment, and off you go with a couple antennas on the roof. Now, this is what the OMVC did in just a two-year period. Notice there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Dallas and Houston, 6 different field tests. You can see the number the amount of data they've taken is large. You can see that for the different cities, they did different types of tests, different reception conditions, pedestrian versus mobile, various coding rates, half rate, quarter rate, mixed rate, VHF, UHF reception, repeaters. They did RF captures, just like there's RF captures for the fixed receiver receivers to use. Now they have them for mobile. And then they also tested some of the early production devices. Now you got to remember something. First of all, the logistics. When you go out in the early part of any project and you say to a broadcaster, like you guys, can I borrow your system? You say, yes, but don't screw up my signal. I'll give you some of the data. But that you can't be expected to, can you put your antenna at the top? Well, I'm going to do that after the transition is done, or a couple years. No, you can't do that. You may not be at full power, which they weren't. Many people have added the vertical component, which is very important, not only to fix, but very important to mobile. But a lot of these tests were run without a vertical component. So it's being run at a disadvantage. And of course, you remember, just like with the fixed terrestrial receivers, the early MH receivers aren't necessarily optimized yet. There's this ramp-up period. So keep this in mind as we go through these results. Signal strength is the main issue. The extra training signals and the turbo coding and the fancy algorithms for equalization, this becomes a secondary issue. It's getting coverage, which is signal strength. You need that. Terrain effect and mobile reception, most terrains outdoor mobile work was within 30 miles. Pedestrian and indoor results, I wish they wouldn't have done it this way, because what does DBM tell you? You really need to know what the field strength is. So I would love to know this number. But they figured it out that you can get indoor reception. However, the most robust is when you do quarter rate for each of those four regions, A, B, C, and D, right? But it didn't, by putting half rate in the A region, remember the A region already is the most robust, they didn't lose much in the way of performance. Well, why would you want half rate? Because you get more data in the A region. So keep that in mind, that the mixed rate did pretty good. The half rate did not do very well, half rate everywhere, because the half rate in regions C and D, which is the most difficult, did not perform well. What else? They tried multiple channel operations. You know, two or three channels, or stations, offered their channel for testing. And if the transmitter sites were reasonably close together and had a comparable ERP and height above ground level, they got pretty good mobile reception. Obviously, pedestrian is more challenging than mobile. High VHF, they don't have as much data on that, but you say, well, how do you get the antenna for high VHF? That's the challenge. Now, mobile side, it's not a problem, but handheld stuff is the issue there. On-shadow repeater did improve both outdoor and especially indoor reception. When you put up multiple synchronized channels, you create echoes. Well, the new system, MA system, that was no problem. The concern is the old legacy system. Now, if you had outdoor antennas mostly in an area with directional antennas and a smart design, you can do it, but you got to be careful. C-pole had significant improvement for mobile when you're outside because you have this vertical whip, right? It helped a little bit with outdoor pedestrian, but indoor it didn't have much help because when you're indoor with no line of sight, you get depolarization anyway, right? But there's very good reason to have at least some vertical component, you know, E-pole, and C-pole is even better if you can afford the power. The RF captures, well, they went out and captured mobile and pedestrian, are useful, especially for receiver manufacturers, because then you could feed the signal into the new receiver, MH receivers. But in many cases, the internal antenna caused 15 or more dB of degradation. This is true of any system, okay? And as you go to lower channels, longer wavelengths, it becomes even more of an issue. So that wasn't surprising. They came up with prediction models for three different scenarios, mobile, indoor pedestrian, outdoor pedestrian, based on the Tyrum propagation model. And they came up with 82, 72, and 55 dB microvolts per meter, respectively. Now, compare that at UHF to your 41 dBU. You say, why is it so much worse? Well, the antenna is one issue. But remember, the legacy 41 dB microvolts per meter is based on what? 30 feet above the ground, 10 dB directional antenna, and so forth. And this is maybe 4 or 5 feet off the ground and a lousy antenna, non-directional and lossy antenna. So that's why you need more signal. Now, some recommendations. Some of these are amazingly obvious, but let's say them anyway. UHF is better than VHF, propagation-wise, the noise issue. Of course, nobody wants low VHF for MH. Nobody wants, right now, low VHF for a lot of things because of the impulse noise issue. Although it does, some things do work on low VHF. Transmitter antenna locate at the highest elevation and closest population. Well, that's a duh. Of course, you'd want that. But you say, I can't afford to do that. Well, you know, you heard Steve Smith talk earlier about the repacking. And some things will get paid for. So if you're going to make changes, now's the time, and you're going to stay in business, now's the time to consider these things. By the way, sometimes people forget about the beam tilt. That was one of the early days back in the 90s. That was mid-90s, mid to late 90s that was talked about for keeping the interference the same out at the horizon or maybe 1 dB lower, and then tilting it down more and putting in a much bigger signal into your area closer to the transmitter, like within 20 or 30 miles, which is where the mobile stuff really, business-wise, is important. What else? Use the maximum authorized DRP, no kidding, but lower antenna gain and higher transmit power just so you can fill in more of the nulls close in. You say, but that's going to cost a little more money. Yes, but do you want... What's more important, what you transmit or what's received, right? So if you want it to be received, you might have to pay a little more in electric bill, put a little higher power, lower gain, fill in the nulls. You want to put the highest quality signal that you can, you know, in terms of phase noise. Of course, you got to meet the FCC emission, Chasing Channel emission mask. This is one that was troublesome in the early days of the legacy system, was clock jitter, so be careful of that. And you guys were getting away, well, in general, broadcasters, some were getting away with, well, I'm going to throw away packets, null packets. And of course, there was always these unexplained glitches they were having every so often that was never proven, to my knowledge, in every case. Here, it's absolutely, positively important to not throw anything away. I promise you, you'll screw it up if you're doing MH. So if you have some of those ASI to SMPTE-310M converters that, you know, will resync the PCRs and so forth, and if you run out of a package, you throw in no packets or take out no packets. You can't do that in MH. Everything's got to be precise. What else? Obviously, you like to include both horizontal and vertical polarization, if at all possible. Even if you just do E-pole, it's better than nothing. C-pole is even better. And what they say is, you know, sometimes you put up you have your horizontal, and then you put up a separate vertical antenna. They say try and avoid that whenever possible, because you may lose your quadrature time phase relationship at parts of your coverage area. Now, you can use distributed transmission, and by the way, doing SFNs are not cheap. But now, you can see from many of the manufacturers, they have digital on-channel repeaters. You say, well, wait, an on-channel repeater, doesn't the output feed back to the input? We've got to be careful, but they have these circuits that now, if you do feedback, it looks like an echo, and it can cancel a fair amount of that. And if what I understand is true, and they work very well, that becomes a lot less expensive than if you were to do the full-blown SFN. And redundancy. This is a point that's always brought up because, well, you know, right now, if you go down with your off-air, well, at least you're on cable or satellite. Well, that wouldn't be true in MH. You go down, you're off. So that's why they suggest if you're going to do this and be serious about it, have some redundancy. Just some closing thoughts. TV stations already on the air with MH across the country. Takes 150K or less to put the proper equipment in to convert. Broadcasters' one-to-many transmission model is a key aspect. It's very efficient what you have already. You've got your infrastructure built out. You've got your spectrum and bandwidth. You don't have to use data plans to use your system. And as we keep saying, it's very reliable in crises. The two mobile groups are still working, fighting hard. They better do something very soon. And by the way, Mobile Content Venture supposedly next week is going to start another big push, if you can believe the rumors that are purposely leaked out. And then you have the tablets, the dongles for tablets and phones, the cellular phone. Part of that leak I told you about also supposedly will announce an AudioVox receiver that takes MHN, RF, and decodes it, and then puts out a Wi-Fi signal. So you can use your tablets or anything with a Wi-Fi smartphone that has the right app in it. And you say, wow, that would be interesting. I could put those as a broadcaster on buses, trains, coffee shops, malls, whatever, and then people could just watch it over their Wi-Fi, local Wi-Fi, without a data plan. But the chicken and egg, this is the problem right now. There's no government pushing this. There's no converter boxes. There's no emphasis other than what the broadcasters can do. So that's where you guys would have to step up. And with that, I'm definitely out of time, and thank you. If there's a quick question, one or two, and then you can talk to me during lunch. My presentation will be on the web whenever they decide to put it there. Oh my gosh. Speak slowly. I'm having a hard time understanding with the echoes in here. Plus, I got bad hearing to start with, so.
I have two quick questions. The data rate for the mobile signal was about 638.
Was what? Say again?
The data rate that we would use in out of our 19.2 megabits.
Yeah.
Did I read that correctly? Is about 638 or 683 kilobits?
You can do whatever you want within the constraints of that. The maximum that you can take away is 14.7
right.
megabits, but you could take nothing away, you could take a little bit away. It's very fine increments. The maximum data rate, it gets a little tricky, it depends on robustness. For the half rate code, you can go up to 2.5 megabits per second with MPEG-4.
Right.
But I wouldn't suggest running all half rate. That didn't perform as well. So it's going to be something less than that. But you've got a lot of flexibility to decide what you want to do. And it depends on your business, too. Are you really interested in more mobile or handheld or both? Okay. Are you sending data that's in a carousel that you can repeat, so if they miss it now, they'll catch it on the second or third go around? You know, there's a lot of variable things to consider.
The other question that I had, the error correction, is that a fixed choice that you make, or can that be changed with the program that you present?
It can be changed with the program. They call these, I talked about MH groups. An MH group fits in a slot. A series of MH groups is called a parade. They got these fancy terms for them. Each parade, which has the Reed-Solomon frame, you can pick out how many, 24, 36, 48. Also, the SCCC, you can pick out quarter rate, half rate, and there's some other variables. So each program can be coded differently. You have that flexibility, a trade-off. Okay?
Hi, Gary. I wanted to answer his question actually a different way.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
He's talking about how much you give up out of the transport stream, and you do it in increments. It goes in steps that are basically 900, and I don't remember the exact amount, like 917 kilobits. So you go 917, 1.8, 2.7, on up as you build an ensemble. And there are eight steps per ensemble. So you can't, it's not just a linear takeaway, it is a stepped takeaway.
Like I said, there's 102 modes. You wouldn't use all of them. So there's finite, but it's, they put in a lot. I find it hard to believe you can't find a combination that you want. Okay? Is there another?
Yeah, looking at the ATSC transport stream, we have a well-known PID, hex 1FFB, that's always going to be the PSIP base PID. Does the MH have something like that, or how does the MH receiver know what the legacy transport stream PIDs are?
It doesn't have to know the legacy PIDs. Okay. Once it knows where its MH data is, then that has its own signaling data to tell you how to decode it. Okay.
So are there standardized PIDs that are used for the MH data? I know that Harris is using, I believe, 1FF6 and 1FFA, but is that standardized with
everybody? You want to know what Harris is doing? You want to tell him?
That one I can't answer.
I can't either.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a specific PID. Don Tenenfeld's probably the expert there.
Yeah, I'm not aware of.
I wanted to add a couple of comments, if sure. I could, to your statement. Just as a quick status report, at the beginning of October, there were 136 stations on the air in 51 markets. By the end of October, that number will grow by something like 28 stations. So there is a push to get more stations on the air as part of the Dial network. And there are a number of new devices that are about to show up. There's going to be a huge advertising campaign that begins right before Black Friday. And there will be a lot of promotion of mobile DTV that will take place over the fall and Christmas buying season.
Do you know anything about the AudioVox rumor?
Yeah, the AudioVox device is indeed, as you described, it is a an ATSC MH to IP conversion device.
Okay, so it's gonna come out.
It is on the boat.
Okay, on the way, all right? All right, thank you.